Hello and welcome back to All My Darlings, where we are reading Harpsong for a Radical, The Life and Times of Eugene Victor Debs by Marguerite Young. We're on page 52, chapter 15. When Karl Marx first heard that Heine was dying, who was already as lonely in some ways as the great auk, who would never hatch little auklets recognizable by him as the children of dialectical materialism, for he parted company with his disciples unless they were wholly like him, as none were. He had written from Paris to his friend, perhaps an even lonelier bird of passage, that of all the people he was leaving behind him in Paris, Heine was the one he would like to pack and take with him into his place of uncertain refuge. The martyr of Montmartre had enjoyed his conversations not only with Marx, but also with his aristocratic wife, who looked upon her husband's endless work as a poem, and although trying to understand, was not always able to understand the sacrifices which were made for its sake. It was Marx's belief that his writings would be published only when they were an artistic whole, as so well-rounded that he could see the entire pattern. He thus, not having the opportunity to submit segments or fragments like those of the fairy tale writer Jacob Grimm. While visiting with the Marx family during their temporary exile in Brussels, the old man Heine, who was already thin as a reed and was to grow thinner with the years, had been able to save Marx's little daughter Jenny's life by turning her upside down and slapping her on the back when she was choking on a fishbone. Marx was so poor that, as he forecast the future of the star that was this world of maelstrom caused by capitalistic greed, when discords were replaced by communistic harmonies, and there should be, perhaps only after some time trapped in the kingdom of necessity, wine and roses, roses all the way, it was a wonder his children did not drink soup made entirely of the boiled bones of starfish, cuttlefish, little birds' feet, shore grasses. He had believed that man must look directly into the eye of the scarecrow, which had been put up by the Philistines to frighten him, and that he must show that he was not frightened. Having read Heine's Germany, A Winter Tale, and other incendiary fables, many pertaining to no limited utopia but the enormous inequities which were fostered against the poor and lowly upon the international scene by the great powers of an expanding imperialism on every front, Marx knew of the borderline or customs house problems which had been those of the long-legged poet when he had first crossed over into Germany, with his head a bird's nest filled with his ideas for world-shaking books. Now languishing in Brussels, Marx was beset by these same troubles with censorship, so kept his messages brief, or took advantage of a messenger to deliver a letter to Paris regarding his book on Born, which was bringing a very loutish treatment from Christian German jackasses. Marx was intending to come to the defense of the living Heine in a controversy that had kept the dead man born in the realm of the living dead, just as did occur so often in Heine's ghost-ridden poems, which should have themselves suggested that he was not a man of the dialectical materialistic persuasion, but rather the non-dialectical spiritual persuasion in which the ordinary laws of nature did not pertain. Indeed, Heine's faith in the age of the machine, which would bring the advancement of mankind, was so altogether minimal as to be almost non-existent. When Heine thought it hit that he would like to be exempt from the monolithic communistic state, which he could allow in no way to weigh down on his ego, crush him like the butterfly beneath the iron wheel of progress, it was impossible for him, with the cataracts like snowflakes blotting out the vision in his eyes, to get beyond the first chapters of the great opus of which he had cut the pages open with his knife, but perhaps could peruse in only a random sense. And he had refused to believe that he must explore the mysteries of the great Hegelian iceberg, which for him was an abstraction filling the void with a theory not so much that what was rational would be, but that what was rational must be. Marx understood that Heine, with his breakages, was a poet and must go his own way. Heine, who in his dreams had explored strange landscapes such as had been explored by real geographers, and such imaginary geographers as Herodotus and Fourier, the latter an influence upon Edgar Allan Poe, demented but lucid visionary. He saw in America strange lagoons, waterlogged marshes, where lilies cried with human voices, and grasses running wild as if they were in panic cried aloud. Icebergs, enclosing the spirits of the dead, had seen Hegel as the mariner who had gone around the entire intellectual world and had fearlessly advanced far up to the North Pole of thought, where one's brain froze when wrapped in abstract ice capes. Lying for years upon his coffin mattress, where he was held down by pins, he who was the lover of the phoenix had recalled that his first great breakdown or collapse had occurred while he was visiting the statue of the Venus de Milo. it having been his sad fate to fall like a clattering skeleton or heap of bones when he had journeyed to the shrine of the marble woman who, unfortunately for him, had an arm broken above the elbow and so could not reach out to save him. When the news was spread by Hein's enemies that he was dead, he had come up with what well might have been a wandering Jew joke. He was not dead, but sleeping. The news of his death had been greatly exaggerated. And yet, after this false propaganda had been spread about, he had felt increasingly that sense of death in the midst of life that had always been his and that was so much a part of the opium-drenched 19th-century psychology of madness and death and dreams, dreams of awakening again, dying again, but to live. It would be remembered of the delicately strung Hind when he was passing away and certainly could not have had the strength to stop the mill wheel of the revolutionary spirit by throwing his body against it, that he had looked like a cross between Mephistopheles and Christ. When the revolutionary opium lady Elizabeth Barrett Browning heard of Hind's public repudiation of atheism for that which seemed a journey of return to the religion of his fathers, about which, wailing as if there were a wailing wall built into him, as would be said of every wandering Jew with his religious songs. The transformation of his openings has seemed pathetic to her eyes and heart. He has joined no church, she had written to a friend, but simply, to use his own words, has returned home to God like the prodigal son after a long tending of the swine. It is delightful to go home to God even after a long tending of the sheep. She knew that Hein, the martyr of Montmartre, whose songs had inspired her to endure her own sufferings, had lived a sort of living death for years in which he had been quite deprived of his limbs and had suffered tortures to boot. When Hein, pinned down like Gulliver by Lilliputian pins upon the striped coffin mattress, were, as he believed, the grave's cold clay would soon stop his mouth from singing his birth and death songs, had given up the god of the pantheists as one he could not use, he had thought that he had done so because of his need of a god who could reach out to help him, and that was why he had sought the transformation that might come if he should advance his journey of return to the god of his father. Poetry had remained, through many deaths, many resurrections, his best friend. Even in his youth he had fallen into that yawning mouth which had opened into the great abyss which was his grave and had taken such a long time spiraling downward that he had not known when he reached his journey's end, for he had awakened from the dream that he was dead. Thank you for listening. Bye.